from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in the hour ahead, earlier this month, Daniel Patterson won the James Beard Award for the Best Chef in the West. The restaurateur made a name for himself when he opened his first restaurant at the age of 25, and since then he has opened a number of establishments, including Qua in San Francisco, a two-star Michelin restaurant, and Plum and Haven in Oakland. He'll join us to talk about Northern California cuisine, his philosophy on food, and why he's relaunching one of his Oakland restaurants. It's all coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, our second hour. Daniel Patterson is one of the Bay Area's most celebrated and innovative chefs. In 1994, he opened Babette's, his first restaurant in Sonoma, at the age of 25. And soon after, Food & Wine magazine named him Best New Chef. That was in 1997, and San Francisco Focus awarded him the title of Rising Star Chef that same year. He's gone on to establish an international reputation and to receive 50 Best Restaurant Awards, most recently named the James Beard Award winner as Best Chef in the West, and he heads up the Daniel Patterson Group of Restaurants, which includes Alta, Qua, Haven, Plum, Plum Bar, and Ume, and he recently published a book of stories and recipes, as well as an array of photographs, and the book bears the name of his San Francisco restaurant, Qua. Joins us in studio for the second hour, and delighted to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Really excited to be here. Thank you very much.
Boy, lots to talk about with you. We've been focusing a lot on food lately. Some people, in fact, may be aware of the fact we had Ruth Reichel on yesterday, and just last week had Michael Bauer on. Sometimes these things just cluster, and it's kind of natural the way they do cluster in that way. In your youth, you wanted to be a writer, though, or a poet, and chose another very lucrative profession, I think is the way you phrase it, to be a cook. I want to talk about your beginnings as a cook, because I know from reading your book that at 14 you were sweeping floors in Massachusetts and kitchens and being a prep cook and then a line cook. What was it that drew you to the kitchen?
That's a great question. I mean, in a way, I spent a lot of time in the kitchen. You know, one of my fondest childhood memories is of my grandparents were, I was very close to them on mother's side. And, my grandmother was a great cook, and she had this way of, communicating through food that was extraordinary. And she was a very quiet person. She kind of kept to herself, but her food was so emotionally powerful that, you know, all of our family would get together, 30 people for the holidays. My mother's side of the family is Russian Jewish. So her cooking was kind of Americanized Russian Jewish food that she learned from her mother. So my mother says that her mother was even a better cook and she was just recreating. But for me,
this is the food that Michael Pollan says is not necessarily good for your arterials.
Oh, no. but you know, I grew up eating borscht and tongue and a lot of things like that. But I would sit with her in the kitchen, and that that feeling of being in the kitchen, of cooking for someone, of you know, the way that she would cook would be she would stay in the kitchen. She would be attached to the stove. Everyone else would be eating and she would never sit down. And somehow that I assimilated that. And when I started cooking, it's funny because the first job I took was in a cousin's bakery, and I scooped ice cream and I cleaned and helped him open. And then I did whatever needed to be done. But when I was 15, I worked in my first actual professional kitchen, and I can't describe it, but I walked into the kitchen and the energy of it, the pace, the way everyone talked to each other and the culture, just instantly I felt like this is my place. And also, as someone who grew up feeling kind of like an outsider, I mean, that's all there is in kitchens, people who don't fit into normal society. And so I walked in, I looked around, I'm like, wow, these are my people. And I never left the kitchen.
And little did you know then that you would be named the best chef in the West. Congratulations for that, by the way.
Thank you very much.
As Wordsworth said, child is father to the man, and the man now is, what a heavy is the head that wears that crown. We were talking, actually, that is best chef in the West. We were talking yesterday, Ruth Reichel and I, just about how it's been a male-dominated profession to a great extent. And she said, yeah, because it's hard work. It's hard labor, and it's a kind of slave labor in many respects. And, you know, she spoke about the importance of getting more women in involved as chefs, and indeed I think that's happening. But it is hard work. I mean, and there's no gainsaying that.
It's very hard work. It's like it's ditch digging. I mean, it's funny because now you have all these television programs and the Food Network, and everyone has this kind of running through fields of daisies kind of idea of what it means to be a cook. It's not that. It's military discipline. It's long hours. If you find a cook over the age of 30 that doesn't have back problems, they haven't been doing it right. I'm actually talking to I want to get a chiropractor to come in and talk to all of like our restaurants about like better ergonomic ways of working. But it's like it's really, really hard. And it's, you know, for 25 years, I've been working, you know, 70, 80, 100 hours a week. And it's just that's what it demands.
But there's joy in it. And I think, in fact, I remember... Well, in your book, for example, you write about, and this is certainly not joy, but the mournful feeling when Alexandra, your wife's mother, died, and how cooking sort of reconnects and helps through the grieving process. And I never thought of it in that light, but indeed, plus, I remember years ago when I interviewed Jacques Pepin for the first time, I said to him, well, what is it about actually cooking a meal, all that work that goes into it and so forth, and all the preparation, everything? I said, what do you get out of it? You know, and he said, the memories.
Yes, and joy, absolutely. There is nothing that makes a cook happier than making other people happy. It's funny. People ask, well, what's the crossover between writing and cooking? And in a way, it's exactly the same. It's about people and it's about communication.
My goodness, so, you use the word voice. You say, I want to find my cooking voice.
Yes. But it's about... communicating ideas, emotion, all of the things that make us human, finding a way to effectively kind of transfer that energy, those feelings to another person. And if you do it well, it's very, very powerful. The difference is if you write something, you write one thing and everyone reads the same thing. You know, if you paint a painting, everyone's looking at the same painting. But if you cook a dish, you have to make that dish over and over exactly the same way. And like, you know, when we're in the kitchen, it's like if we make 50 dishes for 50 people, if we make 49 of them perfectly, then we failed. Because one dish went out not perfect, that's one person's entire experience of that dish. So that's the thing that I think is more challenging about food, is the ephemeral nature of it.
Talking with Daniel Patterson, who has a book out of stories and recipes called Qua, with also some wonderful photographs, and famed restaurateur, recipient of the James Beard Award as Best Chef in the West, and a man who had to struggle to adapt to our languorous culture. But you are well adapted, I must say, and a good writer to boot. So you mostly cook to a great deal. In fact, I'm looking at we brought in some audiovisual aids here, and you can't hear them or see them, but there's all kinds of greens in front of me on a blue tray that Daniel brought in. You cook a lot with plants and vegetables, and I'm looking at lots of green here. Looks very healthy. But you also said that the range of flavors in plants and vegetables far exceeds animals, what one can get from animals.
Wildly. By a factor of 100, 1,000. You know, I mean, the difference between a cow... From place to place and breed to breed, the difference between that and, for example, even an herb from a sage to a tarragon to a basil to a chive, it's hugely different. So animals are base material, and plants are kind of the top note, the grace note, the finishing, the seasoning. So they perform different functions. You can't have an entire meal of herbs, you know, but if you can have an entire meal of animal, But if you only eat that, it's a little bit boring. So the two together kind of make up what is something that's exciting to eat.
But you got some great recipes in here for carnivores.
Yes.
There's even a goat recipe, a lot of recipes involving, well, things like duck and lamb. But I was interested in one particularly that we maybe talk about for just a moment. That is the Prather Ranch beef encrusted in lichen.
Yes.
And actually, I happened to read an article about this. You have to scrape the lichen off, the lichen powder off of the trees for this.
Yeah. So, you know, that's funny. Sometimes I think in cooking, a lot of cooking is, you know, you talk about the hard work and the discipline, but a lot at the same time, you have to be totally tuned into your senses. So like when I'm in the kitchen, I can hear when something's cooking like 15 feet behind me at the wrong temperature. You know, your sense of smell, your sense of touch, your sense of taste have to be very, very sensitive. So while you're kind of doing this brute labor, at the same time, you have to be really engaging with the materials as they are, not as you want them to be, not as you imagine them to be, but you have to be very, very in the moment. So what that means is that sometimes things just fall in your lap if you're paying attention. So I was in a forest in a photo shoot, and they said, put that branch in your basket. And I said, okay, well, there's some lichen on it. I don't use that, but whatever, it's for your photograph. That's fine. Well, they're taking their time setting up the shot, and I absentmindedly, you know, try some because that's what I do is I eat everything. I'm amazed that I'm still alive. And I started chewing it, and it was like...
Yeah, I'm thinking of mushrooms, you know, when you talk about lichen and eating everything.
But that's it. Well,
those out in the forest, some of those mushrooms need to be avoided.
And just to be clear, I don't forage mushrooms, and we don't serve mushrooms that any of our cooks pick. That's something we take no chances with whatsoever because... You die instantly.
You die, exactly.
But anyway, the lichen, almost all species of lichen are not all, but almost all are edible. And when I started chewing it, it tasted like black trumpet mushrooms with like an echo of truffle. And so anyway, I brought it back and cleaned it, boiled it for a couple hours, dehydrated it, and ground it into a powder. It was incredible. And so we put it on the outside of beef and cooked it, and it gave it kind of an aged quality, but also tasted like black trumpet. It tasted like truffle, but really complex and it referenced all those things, but it wasn't specifically. It was a new flavor. And so those moments where you discover something new, not because of anything really that I particularly did, but something kind of I lucked into it.
Caprice. Sure. Sure.
We just kind of went with it.
Is this how you got fried eggs that aren't fried or popcorn grits? Or I mean, some of these things are pretty exotic.
Okay, so fried egg, not fried, that's a great story. So a great friend of mine, Massimo Butura from Austria Francescana in Modena in Italy, one of the great chefs of Italy. And there's a very classic dish, bolito misto. And so he did a modernist version called Bolito Misto No Bolito. And I was talking to him one time, and he was laughing about how widely copied it's been. He says they're even making Frito Misto No Frito. So when he came in for dinner, I made fried egg not fried as kind of a joke. The egg is cooked in it's cooked at a very low temperature in smoked oil and then covered in breadcrumbs. So it looks like a fried egg, but it hasn't been fried. With brassica, and we take the white and make it into a kind of a highly acidic and herbaceous sauce. And, well, it was a great dish. But the way it started was I was making a joke for a friend. And it turned into something that I was like, wow, this is actually great. And we kept making it. So, I mean, a lot of what we do is about ideas and about... being inspired by nature, but also being inspired by culture, things that have been done for thousands of years, or things that our friends are doing, or ways of like in jazz musicians, you know, they'll quote each other, and you won't know unless you actually know everyone's music, and then you realize they threw in a couple bars because someone is in the audience and they just were doing it as a funny aside or as an homage or whatever. And so cooks do a lot of that too.
Yeah, you quote each other. In fact, you quote that infamous line of David Chang's about figs and and chefs in San Francisco, which came back to bite him a bit, but people took it much too seriously.
I don't think he was affected at all. I mean, Dave's a great friend. And, you know, he was playing around. And I think, I mean,
I should enlighten people what we're talking about. I mean, he said most of what they do in San Francisco is they cook with figs. I mean, that the chefs cook with figs. Yeah, I think he was kidding around.
He said all they do is put figs on the plate, do something with your food. He was talking with Anthony Bourdain. I think they were three beers into the night. I don't know. He was kidding, you know, and then he caused such an uproar. And he's like, oh, please, man, I think you guys need to, like, smoke some more pot or something.
It even came up and did an interview with David Chang and David Simon for City Arts and Lectures, who happen to be good friends. David Simon, famous TV writer. And people said, why did you say that about San Francisco? Maybe just a little too sensitive on that score. You were talking about the census before. And when I came in here to the studio, you had this tray with all of these things. You asked me to smell something that smelled like lemon and something else, just to get the olfactory sense of it. It's so important in cooking, much more than people realize. I mean, I have a friend who lost his sense of smell, and he's having real problems tasting now. And I don't think we realize to what extent the olfactory is involved in what we eat and what we appreciate.
Your taste of smell is like, it's like life, you know? It's like, it's not just what you eat. It's the entire world around you. So we evolved from these amoebas that learned to what you could eat and what you couldn't. Like the cerebral cortex. Now there's new science, so I'm not... Don't take this 100%. I don't want callers from telling me that my science is all wrong.
We have neuroscience experts out there, rest assured.
Yeah. Basically, the oldest part of the brain is the part that links your sense of taste, smell, emotion, and memory, which is why we have such strong feelings and such strong memories about what we eat and what we drink. And it's also it comes out of a survival instinct. So you want to move towards what is good for you and away from what is bad for you. And what has happened in our day and age, where survival isn't quite what it was a couple of thousand years ago, is that we can use our basic physiology as a cook to create memories that are vivid. And that's, you know, if you were to ask me what is the most important thing in a dining experience, or a qua especially, I would say that I want people to remember not just the next day, but, like, you know, 10 years later, to remember a dish as if it happened the day before. That it just stays perfectly in their mind. Like, you're at the table for 3 hours, but then imagine keeping something with you for many years. Like, which is more important? It's way more important that something live in your memory. And in order to do that, it has to reach a certain kind of, it has to move you in a way. How that happens is kind of alchemy, and I can't fully control it, and I can't predict it. It's different for everyone.
But you're an alchemist.
We try our best.
Well, and you also, I mean, speaking about your alchemy, in your book you say that the foundation of your cooking is seasoning, not just adding salt, but particularly managing acidity.
Yes. So balance is the most important thing, I would say, in cooking. But balance is like, it's like an internal, a cuisine that's a whole cuisine. So not just different things cobbled together, but something that's integral, runs according to its own internal logic. And so the balance for my cuisine is different than the balance of someone else's. So for me, we use a lot of acidity because there's a lot of sweetness. So we use a lot of vegetables. Vegetables in California are very sweet. And so a lot of aromatics. So, and also my own particular palate, I like things that are bright. I think like things that are fresh, with a lot of life to them. So, you know, in terms of making all that happen, we use way more acidity than most people would think is right. But then you get the dish in the end, and it just tastes good. So the one thing we talk about in the kitchen, like the one word is delicious. Is it delicious? You know? And at the end of the day, if you have to parse that, if you have to think about it, it's not right. And so that's what I tell the cooks. It's like, if you're thinking about it, if it's almost, you know, you're not there. If you have a bite and then you instantly want to take another bite, That's a good sign.
But you keep talking about this almost like an aesthetic perfection or something along those lines. I mean, when you talked before about the 49 as opposed to 50, and now you're talking about it has to be delicious if there's any doubt about the deliciosity.
That's
not even a word.
I think that's what people are paying for. They're not paying for, like, almost perfect. They're paying for perfect. I mean, and it's like, look, if I'm coming into – I feel like I am the biggest customer advocate. I'm always thinking, what if I were the customer? And sometimes someone will put a plate up, and I'll say to them, what if you were getting that plate? What if everyone else got a perfect one and you got that one? How would you feel if you were paying all this money, you saved up, you came into a restaurant? You know, we have a lot of cooks that come into Qua, which I love. And like every night we have like 3, 4, 5 single diners, people who maybe they don't have a lot of money. Maybe they just want to see what we're doing or experiencing it. We have a real responsibility to do our best every time, every dish. So they got, we have a chalkboard, and there's different notes come and go. And there's one thing that never leaves, and it says every table, which means every dish, every diner, every table, the first one of the night, the last, everything has to be exactly the same. Because I think it's not that hard to make something extraordinary once. It's really, really hard to make it extraordinary over and over because you're in this environment that's constantly changing with all of these kind of dynamic influences.
So what do you do when you mess up? I mean, it may be inadvertent, but what happens when you mess up?
It depends. I mean, we have a lot of layers of kind of safety nets. Either myself or my chef de cuisine, whose palate is, I would say, exactly like mine.
By the way, I need to commend you about one thing, because when you got this James Beard Award, congratulations again.
Thanks.
You credited your staff.
I mean,
which I think deserves props to you for doing that. I mean, you know, a lot of chefs have big egos and they don't necessarily, I mean, they want all the glory and they don't necessarily recognize all the people that go into making the stew, so to speak. But anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, you actually bring up a really important point. I mean, people come into cooking for all kinds of reasons. But like for me, I feel as much kinship with home cooks as I do with great chefs. I feel like a cook. You know, cooking is like a cook is identity as much as it is a profession. And part of that is the sense of teamwork and the sense of warmth, of love and generosity and kind of emotional well-being that you get from working with other people as a group to do something really good together. And so it's funny to get an individual award for something. We have 15 people in the kitchen, you know? I mean, not only do I not do everything, with that many people, I do a fraction of what happens. And so I think it's really important. You know, I think definitely you have to kind of focus your attention on one person because you can't talk about everyone. And you know, hopefully I do have something that I bring to the table. But it really is a group effort that is so important. But anyway, Andrew Miller, my chef de cuisine, who's been with us a couple years and who knows the food inside out, either him or me taste everything that goes out of the kitchen. Everything. So it's really difficult for something to get through that's not right.
I want to talk with you about a bit about food snobbery.
Sure.
I mean,
mine or other people's?
Well, a lot of people perceive, especially you know, high end restaurants in terms of. In fact, I read recently because Michael Bauer was on an article he did, sort of defending the importance of high priced restaurants and. Restaurants which aspire to be, as you do, I believe, exceptional. We'll come back to this. Actually, I want to also afford the opportunity for listeners to join us because we're coming up on a break here, and you may want to talk to Daniel Patterson. We'll talk about cooking and talk about really the extraordinary career he's had in the restaurant business. And I know there are many of you who just love to talk about food, so it's a wonderful opportunity to talk about someone who's right at the at the top of the food chain. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can join us now, and we invite you to do that. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments online, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum, and I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with famed local chef Daniel Patterson, chef and owner of Qua, and he recently won the James Beard Award for Best Chef in the West. His restaurants include Qua and Alta in San Francisco, Plum and Plum Bar in Haven in Oakland, and he's recently renamed that Ume. We'll get to snob writing, the snobbery about food in a moment, but the difference in terms of eaters, diners, in Oakland and San Francisco, and some think there's quite
yes,
a yeah,
big tell, difference.
What is it to you?
So we have basically two restaurants in San Francisco, two restaurants and a bar in Oakland. And I live in Oakland. I've lived there for 5 years. I love Oakland. I love living there. I love the culture. I love the people. I am a little bit it's been a challenge owning a restaurant there. My restaurants in San Francisco do great, but I'm a San Francisco person coming to Oakland, and we've been figuring out a new market. And also, area to area, it's very different. So at Haven, for example, it's really kind of gaining steam. Charlie Parker, who was our original chef at Plum, came back 3 weeks ago. I mean, our reservations are up 30%. He's doing a great job. And the format of the menu is settling in. We've got some nice outside dining. It's right on the water on Jack London Square. It's very beautiful. The area is picking up. So we've kind of like, okay, now we know what we're doing there. And Plum, which is an uptown area, is a very young, energetic kind of area. And I was trying to do fine dining. I wanted something like, I don't know, Chateaubriand or something, where you have this very, which is a restaurant in Paris, which is very refined food and very, in a lot of ways, very technical food in this bistro atmosphere. I thought that would be great. Well, you know, Oakland didn't think it would be great. And so we tried a lot of different chefs. And finally, I'm like, you know what? It's not busy. We're not doing the right thing. So let's relook at it. And basically 2 weeks ago, I'm like, you know, let's do something new. So like we had a menu floating around that my business partner Ron Boyd, who is an extraordinary chef and an extraordinary thinker. I mean, he wrote this menu, which for a concept that we never did in San Francisco, I bet he wrote it in 5 minutes, and it was so good. And it was California food with Japanese ingredients. So I took that and I started rewriting it. As I started rewriting it, I just got more and more excited because it's very much how we cook at Qua. Which is, and this is something that's, I think, is really important about San Francisco. So I moved here from Massachusetts, but most people moved here from somewhere. And my wife is four generations here. There's a very famous...
Is she from Chico, in fact?
Yeah.
Or near Chico?
And her father's from Southern California. His parents opened a place called Pine Burger in Pasadena that exists to this day. That's actually pretty well known. And his mother's from her mother's from San Francisco, was. So on both sides of the family. And when we got together, she really, it was very much a turning point for me. She introduced me to a part of California that I didn't really know. I'd mostly stayed urban. And she took me to where her mother lives in the Sierra Nevada foothills in Indian Valley, which is, you know, I talk in the book about, I think there's more animals than people.
If you read your book, you realize how much your cooking has become connected to California and how important California has become to you as a chef.
Yes.
And it's central. And I mean, there's so much in here about, I mean, it was real learning for me, particularly in terms of, this is an interesting example just to use. Crayfish is something you normally don't associate with California. So I'm reading Daniel's book and I'm thinking, crayfish in the Sacramento Delta. I mean, who would have known? I mean, not Krasny, that's for sure. Let me get back to crayfish you normally don't think about with snob eating, but I just want to get you on record about this because you hear a lot about this, you know, people who talk about particularly high-end restaurants and foodies being too snobby about food and all that sort of thing. What do you say to that?
Snobby. So snobby is a really interesting
elitist
word.
Kind of is the synonym.
And elitist too. Yeah. So anything that's expensive is de facto elitist. So by you know that measure, we should basically, you know, wipe out the top level of every kind of art form. You know, we should, you know, basically concentrate only on the middle that everyone can understand. I don't understand how that enriches like humanity as a, you know, in general. I think that the idea, first of all, food, I cook at a lot of different levels. So the food, we were talking about Ume. I was there on the line last night. I was like a line cook. And the food is really simple. It's inexpensive. And I treated it exactly the same way. I feel like you should make a taco with the same sense of love and caring and generosity that you roast a squab. And there's no difference to me. Now, at Qua, we cook a certain kind of food that's very satisfying to me. because it takes into account a lot of historical and cultural, and we have so influences, and we have so many people in the kitchen. We can do things that other restaurants can't do. You know, the herbs that I brought in. I brought in a smattering of herbs from my garden. And that's the nice thing is, like, in Oakland, you can actually have a little bit of space, like San Francisco. So I have a garden. I love it.
And then you know Devella Carpenter's book?
No.
About the urban gardener. She's an urban gardener. Has an urban farm in Oakland.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot of that going. We have chickens at home. You know, I love that. But then I bring things into the restaurant, and that becomes a big part of what we do, but also because we don't serve that many people. I don't need huge amounts, and we can handle things in very precise ways. So we can get a kind of food which is not – I don't think it's elitist. I think it's more vivid, but not because – It's better because we can put more resources to it. Because we put more resources to it, it costs more. So, you know, I don't feel in my heart any different if I'm roasting a chicken at home than if I'm cooking a 15-course meal. It's all the same. Cooking is cooking.
Well, I was kind of surprised to learn that – I don't know why I should have been. You were one of the first to make your own butter. You grow your own sprouts. I mean, all of these kinds of things that are really – say a lot about the commitment to what you do and how you do it. Let me go to our callers here. Before I do, here's William who writes, I've worked in the food and beverage industry for 18 years and worked at Elizabeth Daniel when it was open. That was a restaurant that our guest Daniel Patterson used to have. And William writes, I walked into that job as if it was just another, and by the time I left, I learned that the restaurant industry can actually be a noble profession. I learned more about food and service from Daniel Patterson than any other chef from whom I've worked.
Wow.
Kiyoshi writes, Ruth Reichel says young chefs are challenged and motivated to create foods that are not simply roasting animal protein. What are you doing to create similar delicacies without animal protein and present a creative, delicious menu such as offered at Greens? Well, all I got to do is get his book because, I mean, there's so much in there along the lines that answer that question. Just before I go to some calls here, Rick writes, I wonder if when you cook at home, whether you render fat like chicken fat and use this fat to replace the generic vegetable oil called for in the recipe. This is something that I have picked up and find adds a nice, rich dimension to the flavors.
Well, okay, so we do keep different kinds of rendered fats in the kitchen as we have them, absolutely. We use them for two things. One is we use them for cooking, and two, we use them to hide our dog's medication pills because otherwise she spits them out, so we bury them in bacon fat or something.
I used to just do that with my dog with butter. I mean, put him inside.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Here's Mark who writes, I appreciate the story, knowledge, and passion of Daniel Patterson. However, with astounding prices at Kwa, he cooks for the very rich in our society. This seems very removed from his personal story. Why are the prices so high? How does it feel to cook for the 1%? And how can lower income and average folks experience this food? If we can't, why should we care?
Hey, that's a great question. I can't do it for any less is part of the answer. And maybe you shouldn't care if you can't have that experience and it's not part of your – if it's not part of your value system. I don't – I think there's an idea in current culture that somehow everyone has to have the exact same set of priorities. And if their set of priorities aren't being echoed by someone, then one of the two has to be wrong. I don't agree with that. I think everyone gets to make their own choices in life. And if someone decides, the only thing I really like is to cook at home or to have pizza or to have something very simple, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But if someone does choose to try and do something extraordinary, I don't think they should be criticized for it either. As to who can afford that meal, it's true. We cook for people who have enough money to come into the restaurant, and I don't know what to say.
But you
about
do
that.
Eat a lot of pizza. I read about your love for pizza. You take your family out for pizza. In fact, Tom Keller.
I do eat a lot of pizza.
Tom Keller told me that he loves In-N-Out. He said that on this program. Loves the burgers that have at In-N-Out. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, I mean, I'm sure you, like me, you're very fond of Alice Waters. In fact, I think you described her as what Beatrice was to Dante. But also went on to say some of her influence may be a threat to stylistic diversity and creativity. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. So that's from a story I wrote in 2005 for The New York Times, and which was, I think, one of the most misunderstood and misrepresented 1,700 words that I've ever seen. It's like people who I know have more than a third grade reading comprehension turned that thing inside out as if I was pushing back on the entirety of everything that's happened in the California
the whole food revolution.
Yes. Yeah. Somehow I had became the Antichrist. So what I said was actually very simple. First of all, it was more of a cultural piece than specifically a food piece. I think when you're talking about, you know, Dave Chang's comment, it really sometimes the reaction is more telling than the thing itself. And that's what I felt about this piece. But all I was really saying is I hoped for a culture, society that made more room for people to be different. So food is an expression of culture and it's an expression of people. So saying that it's okay to have different kinds of food is kind of like saying it's okay to have different kinds of people.
Including burgers and pizza and whatever
including
else,
everything.
Right?
Yeah. Including everything.
Okay. We're going to go to your calls. And by the way, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. And there are other ways to join us as well. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll go first to Woodside and welcome David. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I went and I, full disclosure, I saved for a Michelin, two-star Michelin rated restaurant in Madrid once. And I had a cheese plate that 2 years ago that I still remember like yesterday. And I was thinking of your comments of the smells and the experience. But they paired the cheeses sequentially. They said you must eat them clockwise. And they paired it with different wines, et cetera. And it was the most incredible dining experience I've ever had. And I'm not a, oh, I wasn't a cheese person. Now I am. So do you, but I have not been able to find or replicate that experience anywhere. And I've tried. And it's difficult to just go to the store and say, hey, I want XYZ cheese. Do you have any recommendations on best ways to help pair cheeses to, for any restaurants in the Bay Area that you know, provide a sort of an exceptional cheese experience, if you will. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So if you're going to buy cheese, the only person that we buy cheese from is a woman named Soyoung Scanlon and Dante Derry. And she's up in Petaluma. Her goat is Farmstead. Farmstead means that the animals are raised and then the milk and then the cheese is made from that milk all in the same place. She's, I think, the best cheesemaker in the country. Extraordinary. You talked about butter. I mean, it was only because Soyoung started making butter for Thomas Keller at the French Laundry. And I said, oh, the butter's amazing. Can I have some? She said, no. Because when you make cheese, you get the whole milk. You separate it out into cream and milk. Well, cream becomes butter, but then you have to turn the milk into cheese. And then she was at capacity. And so, you know, it's even, you know, the butter was not... I wasn't the one that started it. I would say that, you know, Thomas talked to Soyoung. I saw through Soyoung, and then that's where I got the idea from. So, you know, I would say she's at the farmer's market on Saturdays at the Ferry Building. So that's one great place to start. And in terms of restaurants, plenty of restaurants have amazing cheese plates, and especially a nicer restaurant. We don't do cheese plates, but French Laundry, Manresa, I'm spacing on it, but you know, a lot of restaurants that do kind of more traditional menus will have incredible, incredible cheese selections.
And let me thank the caller. Those memories from Madrid, though, are still intact in his consciousness. And we'll go up to Petaluma. Steve, hi, you're on.
Hi, Daniel. There's a chef here in Petaluma who hasn't gotten the recognition she deserves. She's a former colleague of yours named Stephanie Rastetter, and she runs Water Street Bistro. I'm wondering if you have been to that restaurant, if you're still in touch with her, and what's your thoughts on your experience with her at Rastetter?
Stephanie Rastetter worked with me from the day we opened Babette's until the day we closed. One of my favorite people, like, in the world that I've ever met. You know, you talk about Women in the Kitchen. She had two young children the whole time. She is an amazing cook and a great person. And she after Babette's closed, she opened her own business in Petaluma, as the caller mentioned, Water Street Bistro. I've been there. We stay in touch, not as much as I'd like. I don't stay in touch with my family as much as I'd like, you know, but really, like, we worked side by side for 5 years. I mean, really, there was only two of us in the kitchen. And
that's like a marriage.
It really was. I spent definitely the most time with her during that time than I did for anyone else. And this is important, extraordinarily grateful, because she brought so much to me, to my life, to my understanding of more than just food, but what it means to be a person, to work in a team. And so thank you very much to the caller for allowing me to say how grateful I am.
And we'll go to more of our callers. We go next to Nahid. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Good morning. Well, thank you for taking my call. I have been cooking since I was seven, and I love cooking. I'm passionate about it. After holding a few corporate jobs, now I want to go back to school to either pursue a degree in counseling psychology or culinary school. But I'm thinking, if I'm a really awesome cook, do I really need to go to culinary school to pursue my goal of becoming a chef and working in a restaurant environment, or should I just go and get this other degree that is more, I believe, like, I might need the education for it? But not really sure. I mean,
to become I have an answer for you. So I'm going to give you my blanket answer that I give. So I get this all the time. You know, a customer, their son wants to go into culinary school, a friend, whatever. My first piece of advice is don't be a cook. And my second is, it doesn't matter if you go to culinary school. I never did. Cooking is like, if you have to think about if you want to, you shouldn't do it. You should only do it if you're compelled to do it. And it's really, really difficult to start later in life. It's not impossible, but it's difficult because it's so grueling. And there's parts of the culture that if they're not assimilated into your kind of into your being early, it becomes very hard to get them later. That being said, what I would say, if you really want to do it, find a restaurant that cooks the way you love, you know, that you love the food, and go check it out. Do a stage. See if you like the kitchen culture. There's a lot of different, every kitchen runs different, and there's a lot of different styles. So you might want something that's a little more laid back. You might want something that's more formalized. See if you can get into a bunch of different kitchens, spend a few days here and there, and that will give you an idea if it's really what you want to do. And if it is, choose somewhere, stick to it, make a commitment, and then after a year say, is this what I love, or should I move on?
Let me thank the caller. It actually reminded me, we were talking about the difficulty of women becoming chefs. Ruth Reichel talked about, you know, the difficulty of the labor, but also when you were talking about that former colleague of yours who's in Petaluma, it's very difficult often with women having children because, you know, child care is not necessarily shared equally and all that. But yesterday I spoke to a dozen Coral Fellows. These are young, aspiring journalists. And I found myself saying very similar things. What you said, you know, I mean, there aren't that many women who are talk show hosts either, and there's got to be some glass ceilings broken there. But I found myself really reflecting on the fact that I never had any training to do this. I wanted to do it. And, you know, I was drawn to it the same way you were drawn to the kitchen, drawn to using my voice, drawn to, you know, communicating, getting ideas from people and all of that sort of thing. And in some ways there is an analogy there. But I would also say to people, the first thing you said, don't do it. I mean, because it's a very rough kind of job in many ways, but also demanding. And there are a few of us who get through the net and you know, wind up behind the microphone, just like there are a few who have, heaven knows, you know, the kind of success that you've had. Here's Michael, who says, a dish which seems perfect to you is returned to the kitchen. Your guest thinks the fish is overdone or underdone. What do you do? How do you combine what you know is right with what pleases your guest?
Oh, we go out to the restaurant and in the dining room, we yell at them. Yeah. No, I mean, it's like I'm not eating the food they are. So you want your meat well done, you want this, you want that. I mean, sure. The question is, can we do it? If we can do it, we will. But there are some things that we are not physically able to do, and then we'll explain that and we'll try and find We'll send them another dish. Sometimes people just don't like things. You know, we have people coming from all over the world. You know, about, I don't know, 50% of our clientele is from around the country, around the world. And so people might just not like cheese, for example, or they might not like this or not like that. Everyone has allergies. And so what we do is, and that's also part of our responsibility, is not just cook what we love, but to meet people halfway. And if they tell us, if they take the time and to tell us what they want, how could we not listen to them? I mean, it's their meal.
But there's also, you have the two Michelin stars. When you start getting those Michelin stars, people's expectations soar. I mean, they become sometimes really almost celestial or very inflated.
Well, I mean, that's a great point. And so everyone comes with their own expectations. So this is the thing about food is that everyone knows intimately their own likes and dislikes.
And their palates are often quite different.
And their palates are often different.
Yeah.
And so we cook one way and we cook consistently our way. But if someone wants something different, no problem.
I thank Eric for this tweet. He said, new word, I love it, deliciosity. I don't know where that came from. That's what we used to call a neologism. Another tweet from a listener says, Daniel, kudos for recognizing home cooks. Creativity and sensuousness is integral to cooking, as is discipline. Cook is as much an identity as his profession. Can you talk about vegetarian food in high-end restaurants and how they can offer a wider gourmet range?
You mean like we do?
Well,
yeah. So I want to go back to one point. You're talking about women chefs, and I think this is something that's very complicated, and our media, unfortunately, tends to be very reductive. So it's just there's not enough women chefs, but it's actually very complicated, and it does have to do with also not just how women are supported within the kitchen itself, but how they're supported within the media. So we have actually one of our chefs, Kim Alter, extraordinarily talented. And we're actually going to help her open her own restaurant in San Francisco, which I'm really excited about. But, you know, I've looked at how maybe some of her, some of the other people who are about her age who are male are getting more press that I think that she should be getting. And so it's a very complicated issue. I think the responsibility with restaurateurs is how can you create a level playing field? And that is really complicated given all of the factors, but I think at least you have to start with saying we want to. But then I think there's this other thing where the support that kind of the wider media gives is a little bit slanted. So anyway, getting back to your question, what was your question again?
We go on to another email here. This is Linda who writes, my husband and I love plum. But the atmosphere was not fine dining. Sitting at picnic tables, hard, no backs, is not comfortable. Many of us who have money need a little more cush at our age. Plum is not the only restaurant with this problem. I would have come more often with more comfortable seating.
That is a great point. It is not fine dining. It was never intended to be fine dining. The food was refined, but it was meant to be a neighborhood bistro. So now it really is a neighborhood bistro. The music is loud. The chairs are wood. The food is inexpensive. It's built for sharing. It is really delicious. It's vegetable forward, heavily ingredient based. But if you're looking for a quiet, fine dining experience, that's not what it is. That's what we do at Qua. So I think that part of we were talking about expectation, actually, I think before. And, you know, part of expectation that people bring, for example, with Michelin, they expect the caviar card and the cheese card and all of these traditional things. Well, we don't do that. We offer a few moments, enough to recognize, like, but there's very little butter in our menu. There's no cream whatsoever. There's a little bit of creme fraiche on one of the dishes. So someone else might come from a more modern perspective and really love that. So it's a funny thing. And I first of all, I'm sorry that the chairs weren't comfortable enough and that you weren't happy. I mean, I'm never, never, never happy to hear that someone was disappointed. But sometimes the disappointment comes because we don't do our jobs right. And that's our responsibility. Sometimes the disappointment comes because they're expecting something other than what we are.
But it's abundantly clear that your emphasis is on food there. And that's Also, speaking about your emphasis on food, when you open your book, and the book is Qua, I mean, it's about the food at Qua more than it is about Plum or other restaurants.
It's only Qua.
It's just Qua. But early on, there's a tasting menu, and you say, and I'm quoting, one of the, all I know as a professional cook and all that I care about is in the tasting menu.
Yes.
Oh, that's a pretty grandiose statement.
No. Okay, so what? There's me as a chef, me as a restaurateur, you know, me as a father, and a husband, and a family person, and a friend. And so, in the very narrow respect of me as a professional chef, I've had a tasting menu since 1994. It is the only form I've ever explored because it allows the most latitude to the most imagination. It requires the most discipline. It's the hardest form to do well because it easily tumbles into just kind of it can be silly. It can fail. It can be all kinds of things. It's so complicated to do it well. What really appeals to me generally across any discipline, I want to do something that's really hard to do. I want to do something that's right at the edge of failure. I'm not afraid to fail. And if I feel like I'm not failing, then I'm probably not trying hard enough. That is me personally as a cook, as a chef. It's not like a value judgment that I'm trying to, you know, spread. It's like I actually think that less people should do tasting menus because I think people dabble in them. And this is, I guess, what I was trying to say. You have to make a commitment because, you know, the demands are broad and they're very extensive.
Well, congratulations again on the James Beard Award. It's quite an honor. Best chef in the West. And the book is Qua, Stories and Recipes, Daniel Patterson. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED, we appreciate your listenership. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.